The following was written by Elizabeth Morrison and pasted into her photo album.
I made application for enrollment in the American Red Cross, July 1916. I was accepted and joined the emergency unit of Peoria nurses. In August 1917, I took the oath of allegiance and entered the Army Nurse Corps as a reserve nurse. On August 12, 1917, I left Peoria in company with 8 other nurses of the Peoria Emergency Unit, going to Camp Cody at Deming, New Mexico. The hospital at Camp Cody was a base hospital of 1,000 beds. Camp Cody was a training camp for the 34th Division, called the Sandstorm Division, and composed principally of men from Montana, Minnesota, Iowa, and the Dakotas. Magnificent fellows they were, and here they spent months in preparation for service overseas. There were many deaths from pneumonia among these boys at Camp Cody, who made the supreme sacrifice just as truly and heroically as those who died over there. I remained in the services at Camp Cody for 10 months, when 10 of the nurses received orders to proceed to New York for a destination unknown to us. Arriving at New York, the government equipped us with clothing and uniform. The uniform consisted of a blue Norfolk suit and ulster, raincoat and rain hat, army shoes, rubber boots, gloves, and sweater. We were also given 1 Valor and 1 straw hat. We remained in New York for 3 weeks. During this time, some 1,500 Army nurses were in the city preparing to go overseas. We had daily infantry drill in companies of 300 at one of the armories. We lived, moved, and had our being to the count of 1, 2, 3, 4. At that time, the people of New York had not become acquainted with the uniform of the Army nurses, and they thought us to be soldiers' widows or policewomen. On June 18, 1918, orders were given to 101 nurses to be on board boat by 1 o'clock the next afternoon. After receiving these orders, we were not allowed to communicate with anyone by telephone or letter, and were told to proceed to the boat, name unknown, by 2s and 3s, these groups to leave the hotel at different times and in such a manner as to attract no attention. Our boat proved to be the Walmer Castle, a British boat of the Castle Line. There were 1,800 soldiers and 150 officers on board, in addition to the 101 nurses. There were 13, mind you, transports in our fleet as we left the harbor in battle formation at 7 a.m. on the 19th of June, 1918. No one was allowed on deck as we pushed from the dock, nor until we had passed the Statue of Liberty. For several days, we were convoyed by 1 American battleship, 7 American destroyers, and 4 seaplanes. The German submarines had but a few days before appeared off the Jersey coast and had sunk a number of merchant boats. Hence, extra precautions were taken for our safety as we set out upon our voyage. The American battleship remained by us for 11 days, leaving us during the 11th night out. When we woke on the morning of the 12th day, as we neared the Irish coast, we found we were being convoyed through the submarine zone by 9 British destroyers and several British airships. They remained with us till we reached the coast of England. As we sailed down the coast of Ireland, we sighted and passed close by a sister ship of the Castle Line. We hailed her, waved our handkerchiefs, and the boys whistled a noisy salutation, which was returned by those upon the other boat. When we reached Liverpool, we learned that this boat was a hospital ship bound for Canada with wounded Canadian soldiers, and that it had been attacked, torpedoed, and sunk shortly after passing us, with the loss of all on board except those who escaped in a single lifeboat. Even the other fleeing lifeboats had been fired upon and sunk by the submarine. Among those lost were all the nurses on board. We were 3 days passing through the submarine zone. During that time, we did not go to bed. We experienced but one scare when one of our boats fired at a submarine, and the entire fleet maneuvered to evade a chance shot from the underseas pirate ship. We disembarked at Liverpool on the morning of July 2, 1918. We were greeted at the dock by a band playing American airs. The band was composed of boys too young to be in service and was led by an old man too old to be in service. We took train for Southampton, whence we were to cross the channel. We were held aboard boat here 2 days and nights before crossing, because the submarines were reported to be active in the channel. We spent the 4th of July at Southampton, and on that day visited the boys at the rest camp for American soldiers. Here we began to realize the sort of welcome that the boys everywhere showed for the nurses of the American Red Cross. There was nothing finer in the whole story of the war than the attitude of the boys toward the nurses. We landed at Le Havre on July 7th. Here we boarded a train for what point we knew not, but we learned that we were bound for Blois, the nurses' mobilization center. We were now on army rations, and the American boys detailed at the railroad station at Le Havre as MPs and assistants were charged with supplying us with rations for the remainder of our journey. They saw to it that we were well supplied. They loaded our apartments full of bully beef, canned beans, jam, and hardtack. We had been given no eating utensils, however, so washed our soap dishes and nail files, and thus supplied the lack of plates and knives. We reached Paris in due time. Here, we met trainloads of American boys in the railroad station, some moving to the front, some returning from the trenches. Thinking that we had reached the end of our journey and that we would need our supply of rations no longer, we unloaded our surplus of bully beef, etc., on these boys, who were glad to get a little extra supply. We saw Paris from an army truck. We were whirled away, standing packed in great trucks, across the city and down Avenue de l'Opéra and other famous boulevards to another railroad station, where we entrained again for Blois. But before leaving, we had to buy our own dinner in Paris. We reached Blois at midnight. Another truck ride brought us to a base hospital, accommodating 1,000 American boys. It was an old chateau by the river, built of stone, walled in and surrounded with magnificent old trees. It was a meandering sort of an affair, court after court and building after building. The footfalls of soldiers resounded through its long stone corridors, and its dark corners and most forsaken rooms were filled with wounded American soldiers. The mess hall had at one time been the chapel. Here I went on temporary duty the next morning. All of the boys who came under my care here had been gassed. 2 days later, we received orders to have our suitcases packed and be ready to travel and be down in the courtyard at 8 o'clock the next morning. Army trucks took us to the station, where we boarded a train that landed us again in Paris. Waiting trucks took us out to the American Red Cross Military Hospital No. 2. This was a French hospital located in the fashionable residence district of Paris, near the site of the Arc de Triomphe. It had been taken over by the American Red Cross and the American Army. It was a surgical hospital containing 300 beds, but was often crowded to double its normal capacity. Here, finally, I became a fixture in the service. Colonel Joseph Blake, a noted surgeon of New York, was the commanding officer. It was a rare privilege to be in the service associated with men of his standing in the profession. The hospital was splendidly equipped with every known facility for hospital services. The operating rooms were models in their appointments. Day and night teams worked incessantly in these rooms. And during the drives, when the wounded were pouring in, the doctors, nurses, and corps men worked day and night, stopping only long enough to eat a hurried meal. They paid no attention to hours on duty, but all worked till the full measure of endurance was spent. This spirit of service and helpfulness moved even the boys themselves. Private R had been severely wounded at Chateau Thierry. A shell struck him, and it was necessary to remove his right arm and right leg. The next morning after the operation, when the nurse brought him some nourishment, he said, "Nurse, you are very busy. I can feed myself." My first patients were all boys sent back from the Chateau Thierry drive. By hundreds, they were brought on stretchers into the receiving ward. Here, their wounds were dressed, after which they were assigned to beds in the wards or to cots in the corridors or mess hall. Even the chapel and garage were filled with cots, and stretchers lined the sidewalk, on every one of which lay a wounded American soldier. This was the toll of every drive. The boys were universally patient, uncomplaining, and cheerful in their suffering and pain. Their heroism in the battlefront was no greater than their heroism on a hospital cot. One of them had gone over the top and was severely wounded just before hostilities ceased. The news came that the armistice had been signed. "Gee," he said, "that's just like me. I never could hold down a job." At night, we were often aroused by the approach of enemy air raids over Paris. And during the day, Big Bertha pounded away at the city. Warning of an approaching raid was given by shots from the anti-aircraft guns and the wailing of the siren. Instantly, all lights are extinguished in the hospital. Patients on the upper floors, walking cases, take blankets and pillows and go to the first floor. But the night nurses and orderlies remained at their post of duty during all raids. The noise of an air raid was intolerable. The booming of the anti-aircraft guns, the explosion of the bombs, and the roar of the planes made a din of battle. I remained at hospital number 2 for 8 months. The boys came and went. Some passed beyond. Others recovered of their wounds and returned to renew the fight, while still others were invalided home. The hospital was closed on February 1, 1919. I reached America, landing at Newport News on March 13, 1919.